Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The United States was once seen as a world leader when it came to nation building, peacekeeping, and defending democracy. This was especially evident during and after World War II, when President Roosevelt called the nation the arsenal of democracy for its role as a supplier of weapons and supplies to the Allied nations. The White House recently announced plans to withdraw the U.S. from over 60 international organizations. In addition, recent actions in Venezuela and plans to exercise its might are changing the perception of the U.S. as a world leader. We're looking at what this means for the United States on the world stage. Joining us now is Daniel Forty, head of the U.N. Affairs for the International Crisis Group. Welcome to All Sides, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So in your role as head of U.N. Affairs for the International Crisis Group, how have you seen the image of the United States change recently?
We've seen a country that is a permanent power on the Security Council and has long been the financial underwriter for a lot of the UN's work on peace and security, development, and humanitarian affairs shift since Trump came back into office a year ago. Under Trump 1.0, back from about 4 or 5 years ago, we saw that Trump really didn't like some parts of the UN, but didn't fundamentally upset the US's role at the world stage. This has been very different come last year. We saw the immediate wave of aid freezes and budget cuts hit a lot of the UN's work immediately and force the organization into shock therapy. We've seen the US withdraw from major climate and human rights bodies in the organization, signaling that Washington was no longer going to defend a lot of the normative values that the US had stood up for in previous administrations. And we've seen the US use both its political leverage and its financial might to really try and curtail the organization's priorities and get a shift more towards focus on what the U.S. wants to see from international cooperation. So very much multilateralism on America's terms. And this has really changed, you know, the role of the U.S. as a major power on the world stage in a lot of areas where previously most countries around the world had taken for granted that Washington would always be a major partner and supporter of multilateral cooperation.
Yeah, I've always wondered, you know, the U.S.'s role in the U.N., because there's lots of countries involved. I don't know if the United States, like, disproportionately paid more dues because of the size of our country or our influence, or if we had a bigger might, a bigger role in it. How does the United States not being as fully involved in the UN impact the UN? What percentage of was the US important here?
Absolutely. So there are a couple of ways to look at it. On perhaps the peace and security front, the U.S. remains a permanent member of the Security Council, and it still has its right to use a veto on any resolution that gets put before the 15 member state body. And this is a position that, you know, even regardless of who's in the White House, this is an important role for America to play for its own interest to be able to engage and dictate sort of what areas the U.N. can sort of have multilateral cooperation on peace and security. By being a permanent member, the U.S. has also been positioned as a main financial backer. Mm-hmm. It pays the most money to both the U.N.'s regular budget and to support U.N. Blue Helmet peacekeeping around the world. Separately, one of the bargains we've seen the U.S. make with the rest of the world over the past three decades is that the U.S. has been the single largest funder for a lot of the U.N.'s humanitarian work, whether through agencies like the World Food Program or UNICEF, the children's agency. Now, I think that's the part that a lot of colleagues took for granted here in New York. And when Trump and Secretary of State Rubio announced major aid freezes last January, that was an issue where few diplomats were prepared for the shock of the system. I mean, you've seen some parts of the UN system have to cut thousands of jobs pretty much in a span of weeks because they depended on the US for anywhere between 20 to 40% of their funding, which was largely coming through voluntary means. So we've seen on lots of areas just Washington has, while it used to buy into the totality of the system, it's now very much trying to focus on only the parts that it sees to be in American interest.
We'll get more into those organizations that we left, but first, you said that, the United States was seen as the single largest funder for some of these groups and this whole division of what the UN does. But I mean, you could definitely see, of all people, President Trump with his America First agenda. He would look at this and say, "It's a big world. Other people should pay." So people like you probably weren't surprised, right?
Well, I think there are some aspects we expected the US to not favor, on climate cooperation, on gender equality. There's been very clear signaling since the first Trump administration that those were no, those weren't in the worldview of the current administration in office, and the US didn't support US American money going to the UN and other parts of the multilateral system working on those priorities. What was quite surprising, frankly, is the magnitude and the swiftness of the change that America imposed on the multilateral system and the pretty abrupt nature that the rest of the world has had to respond. This has led to a major sort of downsizing process here in New York and in UN places around the world, a lot more hyper-prioritization, and a situation where the UN, which is often the last lifeline to protect civilians, to provide vaccination campaigns, to support children's education, just can't be in as many places as it has been around the world. Now, I think the argument that the Trump administration is making is that if they can't see an immediate and direct material benefit of American money to American citizens, then it's not in their interest. And I think where, what we've seen almost every other administration understand is that, the UN is the sum of its larger parts. And buying into lots of different parts of the system, whether they benefit American citizens at home or abroad, or whether they support individuals in conflict-affected countries where the US only has a secondary interest, global stability, large, more sustainable development, a more healthy global population will have knock-on effects that ultimately are in the American interest. And it's this notion that the Trump administration has turned on its head over the past year.
So I mentioned that the U.S. has plans to exit from more than 60 international organizations. We can't list them all here and explain them all, but can you give us some examples? What's an international organization the U.S. is exiting support from or exiting involvement in that sticks out for you?
Sure. The list of 66 organizations spans parts of the UN and other international bodies. I mean, some, quite frankly, are ones that I've never heard of. For example, a committee on zinc and lead studies, which, as someone who focuses on multilateral cooperation full time, that one wasn't on our radar. There are parts of the UN where the US is announcing of a withdrawal or boycott will have lasting effects. The major one is the UNFCCC, which is the treaty-based climate body that sort of underpins international discussions on climate adaptation and was the key vehicle to bring together the Paris Climate Accords in 2015. This withdrawal is significant and perhaps unique among that list because it is an organization based on international treaties, which means that in order for the US to possibly rejoin in the future, the next president would need to get Congress to sign off on a new treaty to join. And given where we've seen changing attitudes in much of Congress around climate action, this is something that will be much harder for the US to re-engage on under subsequent administrations. Other parts of the withdrawal are a bit odd in terms of the fact that the US withdrawal is more signaling than it is sort of substance. For example, there are parts of the UN Secretariat, which is sort of the main principal organ of the UN, where the US can't withdraw because it's not a treaty member. For example, there are economic commissions on different regions in the world. There are bodies related to international law or trade where the US doesn't have any special funding or programs. It just pays into it as part of its regular membership dues for the organization. So in practice, that may mean it just stops attending meetings and having high-level discussions with the leaders of those departments. On the peace and security side, there are one or two that stand out to us. There's a small committee that deals with conflict prevention and post-conflict recovery, where the US has a permanent seat because of its membership on the Security Council. And while the US may not like funding some of that work, the fact that it doesn't want to participate in those discussions seems short-sighted, in the sense that, preventing conflicts in areas at a moment when the US is not engaging in much diplomacy on forgotten places around the world and smaller conflicts that aren't directly involving American personnel or direct interests seems to be a short-sighted decision. Otherwise, stability elsewhere should have a long-term benefit for the US. The last thing I'll say is that, there is a common thread throughout this entire list, and it reflects the priorities of what the current administration views are not in it's the American interest. So we see, the withdrawal from bodies that deal with sustainable development in conflict-affected states or countries that need more development assistance. We see withdrawals from bodies dealing with climate action, on gender equality, and international law. And based on U.S. foreign policy over the past year, this is wholly consistent with that messaging the White House is sending elsewhere.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how the U.S. is exiting international organizations and whether that is changing the United States' place in the world, with Daniel Forty, head of UN Affairs for the International Crisis Group. And I looked at the list of some of the organizations, and as you said, now for me, I don't work in this world, so there were many I had never heard of. Some of them you can figure out what they do based on their title, others not so much. One that stuck out for me was the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. So that was probably like the United States helping countries have their first ever election or something like that. Or, well, I guess the UN helping and the United States supporting that. Am I getting that right just based on the title?
Yeah, I think that sounds correct.
And so, and then there's another one, the Partnership for Atlantic Cooperation. They're leaving that. That seems like something just from the title that we would need to be interested in. Do you know about that group?
They don't fall directly within the UN system, so I don't keep regular track on them. But I think those types of bodies are reflective of how the US has approached international law on the world stage. I mean, we saw last week there be an urgent meeting of the Security Council following Washington's operation in Venezuela to capture the President Nicolas Maduro. And quite frankly, the US was pretty isolated on the world stage in not only rebuking core tenets of international law and the UN Charter, but making the case that because this was a domestic law enforcement priority, basically that international law didn't apply to this context. And so I think the withdrawal from some of these multilateral bodies that deal with, perhaps smaller issues related to governance and cooperation on the finer points of international law are just reflective of this larger trend where the US doesn't want to engage on discussions around the rules of the game that they feel would be binding on what an American first foreign policy would actually mean.
So those ones that I gave the example of, the one with the electoral assistance, the Partnership for Atlantic Cooperation, those are examples of there's international organizations that are directly related to the UN, and then there's other international organizations that just exist. And he made an executive order to exit like all kinds of different things. Is that right? Am I understanding
exactly
that?
Exactly. So in January 25, the White House put out an executive order announcing about a 3-month review of every aspect of UN and US engagement with international bodies, including but not limited to the UN. So this list is a mix-up of both sort of UN-specific entities and others that are, more reflective of other parts of international cooperation that past U.S. administrations have seen important to at least engage in and be a part of the discussion, and in some cases provide financial support to.
And just a couple of questions about some other organizations, not to pick on them, but like there was one called the International Cotton Advisory Committee and the International Tropical Timber Organization. For tropical timber, I could see the Trump administration saying, yeah, we don't need to be involved in that. There's the other countries can deal with tropical timber. For Cotton Advisory Committee, I could see the Trump administration saying maybe a cotton business could be involved, but not the federal government. Do you see that whenever you read these?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine there at one point or another there was a sound logic for the US being involved in a lot of these in forms of international cooperation. But I think the underlying point for all of this is that, you know, the international system and the multilateral ecosystem we have today is not just about the Security Council, is not just about the Human Rights Commission. It's a lot more about sort of the underwiring of how states cooperate today. And there are so many areas where there need to be common rules of the road to facilitate issues that the average American citizen takes for granted, whether it is on small businesses, whether it is on, you know, postal cooperation or the rules for common aviation systems. These are things that most people don't take for granted and are not the fascinating parts of sort of high politics in international affairs. But they do reflect that the international order does require every country to buy into a common system and to engage on areas where they have a defined set of rules and a space for impartial discussions that allow the system to work and states to actually, you know, pursue trade and development in a way that suits them. And the fact that the Trump administration is signaling that it's no longer interested in those parts of international cooperation sends another red flag that the current White House wants to rewrite international cooperation on its own terms and dictate it in a way that benefits primarily the American people, regardless of the knock-on effects.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, if I mail something and I want it to go to another country, I want it to go there after it leaves the hands of the U.S. Postal Service. If I'm on a flight, I want my flight to be able to go to other countries as well. That makes sense. Apologies to cotton and tropical timber and lead and zinc. You know, we just there's 66 organizations on the list. We pick and choose. But before I let you go, I wanted to just ask you, because you've mentioned a few times here in New York, where the UN headquarters is. So given that the United States is withdrawing from its role in this world stage type organization, is there concern that the United Nations will move its headquarters to another country?
We don't get the sense that that's a serious discussion right now. For all of the Trump administration sort of attempts to rewrite parts of this international framework, they still see important opportunities to actually work through the UN, particularly on peace and security, in a way that does benefit the American interest. You know, we saw back in the fall the US having to really push its ceasefire plans through the Security Council in order to get a lot of countries to even consider talking about what it would mean to join an international force in Gaza or to sign off on the Board of Peace that's set to, you know, spearhead phase two of the ceasefire in a place in the US's backyard in Haiti. Washington has had to work through the UN to mobilize a coalition to fight gangs that have destabilized conditions in the small country. And in other places, even in the DRC, where President Trump oversaw a signing of a peace deal not 2 months ago, there are about 10,000 UN peacekeepers on the ground there that are doing the day-to-day work to protect civilians and try to stabilize the conditions so that the political deal that the Washington invested a lot of time and effort with others to support can actually take root. So while the US may have a slightly more narrow aperture about what it wants from multilateral system, we don't see it wanting to disregard and throw away the system entirely. And the US allowing New York to relocate to other places around the world, regardless of the economic or political case for doing so, clearly doesn't match with sort of the US is reading that it does want some things from international cooperation, even if a different pattern from past administrations.
We have been speaking with Daniel Forti, head of UN Affairs for the International Crisis Group. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the environmental impact of leaving some of these organizations. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. U.S. support for over 60 organizations has been suspended via executive order by President Trump. Among the organizations, they are addressing global challenges. We're now going to talk about the environmental impact of withdrawal from international organizations and what it means for the United States' standing on the world stage. We're joined now by Bart Elmore, who teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State University. Welcome back to All Sides, Bart.
Thanks for having me.
And in a speech given back in 1988, Republican President George H.W. Bush addressed the issue of global warming.
And these issues know no ideology, no political boundaries, not a liberal or a conservative thing we're talking about here today. They're of equal importance to the developing world and to the developed world. Just as they are the common heritage of the past and the present, they are the common agenda of the future.
So what stands out about this is that the GOP isn't known for its belief in global warming as a problem needing to be solved. This is especially evident with the Trump administration's latest actions. So, Bart, what environmental organizations is the U.S. withdrawing support from? What sticks out to you that makes you concerned?
Well, I think there's two, and that quote, I think, is relevant to it. There are several, as you were going through in the first segment, that are at stake here. But the two biggest are the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
That's in the previous segment, he called it the UNFCCC.
Only the UN can create these wonky acronyms,
yes.
Right? So UNFCCC, which was signed into law as a treaty in 1992 by George H.W. Bush. It was ratified unanimously by the Senate, which tells you, how bipartisan that was even in that moment. And that was the kind of foundational text that shaped all future international negotiations around climate change. So that's one that we've pulled out of under this executive order that was signed. And the second is known as the IPCC. Again,
and what's that stand for?
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So if the UNFCCC set up the framework for state diplomats to negotiate climate change, the IPCC is the international scientific body that puts out the best science we know on climate change. And that requires funding. So now that's not going to be funded by the United States, but it also includes U.S. scientists. And so there's questions about, are federal officials going to be able to participate in the same way in this kind of scientific journey to understand climate change? So those are the two big agreements that we pulled out of.
And their agreements, are they groups? Do they have an office? I'm just trying to understand, because some of these are agreements. Some use the word treaty. Some call themselves organizations.
Yeah, they do. So in the case of the UNFCCC, the UNFCCC, they have an office in Bonn, Germany. And interestingly, the United States has traditionally provided about 20% of the funding through this agreement to make sure that the staff, I think there's over 400 staff that actually are trying to arrange and coordinate all the different meetings that happen around that agreement. The meetings are known as COPs. And, I've been to several of these. The Conference of the Parties, another acronym for you, to the original UNFCCC. So when you
The last time you were on the show, you came here to talk about COP28.
Yeah, and
so
exactly.
If you want to know more about that, listen back.
Exactly. Yeah. COP28, COP29. We're now at COP30. And then actually the next one will be COP31 in Turkey. And so there is a tremendous – imagine that – every country in the world is a signatory to this original agreement of the UNFCCC, which I think is something to just sit with for a second. The United States is now the only country that's saying, no, we don't want to participate in that in the world. And what that means is there's just a ton of bureaucratic apparatus that has to be negotiated, organized, and structured. And so there's a lot of cost to that. There's a lot of staff to that. So yes, there are physical spaces for these entities that are going to lack some funding and support as a result of the United States stepping out, outside of the fact that the United States isn't going to be in the negotiating room helping to promote U.S. interest in those conversations, which are going to happen whether the United States is there or not. So I think that's the big issue here.
We can just leave this with an executive order. Like, Congress didn't need to vote?
This is the question.
This is
the challenge, right? So as a historian, you know, you go back to that moment, and it is worth, you know, just sitting with that. Think about that in 1988. He's campaigning against Michael Dukakis, and George H.W. Bush is out in front in some ways on the issue of climate change. He's being very vocal. This is during the campaign. And, you know, going into this, this is a really big decision to send this to Congress and have this be a treaty, because you have to have two-thirds of the Senate ratify it. So, yes, this is what really struck us as historians when we saw this pull out, because this is different than when you might have heard, oh, we pulled out of the Paris Accord. Well, the Paris Accord was from 2015. It was at COP21. It was a very specific agreement that was about the kind of pledges nations were going to make to try and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But that was not a treaty ratified by the U.S. Senate. At the time, Barack Obama was president. He recognized that he couldn't get Senate ratification if he tried to bring it to the Senate. So he signed that via executive order. Now, on the one hand, that was good because it meant the U.S. could show its commitment. Mm-hmm. The downside was when the Trump administration came in 2017, they immediately announced that they were going to pull out. And they could do so because it was an executive order.
So Obama kind of set the precedent there.
Yeah, okay. He noticed that going to the Senate wasn't going to work. And so he had to do it by executive order. So we pulled out of Paris. And what that allowed was when the Biden administration came in, we got right back in. Mm. And when I was at COPs, it was very exciting to see the U.S. back in the negotiating rooms. Everyone was excited. And then, of course, the Trump administration came back in. It was like whiplash. Mm. We pulled right out of the Paris Accord again. But this was the next move. Not only are we going to pull out of the Paris Accord, the specific agreement negotiated in 2015, what Trump is doing here is saying we're pulling out of the you might call the mothership agreement that started in 1992. Again, supported by everyone in the Senate, Republican and Democrat at the time. And the question is, can you unilaterally, as president of the United States, pull out of a treaty that's been ratified by the Senate? And it's an unanswered question to some degree. Legal scholars are debating it. The Constitution, this is where history matters, is very clear. In Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, it says that you have to have a two-thirds vote of the Senate to affirm that treaty. But it's silent on what happens when you pull out. Do you need to go back to the Senate to get that approval?
So the writer of that article in the Constitution never thought that we would leave something. They didn't think of that.
As a historian, I just have to almost laugh. I think they probably weren't thinking about a lot of the things that are happening right now.
Indeed.
Because I think we're so much is being thrown. Mm-hmm. Constitutional questions are being thrown there. So we don't know. It's because there is a silence there. It's very possible that this will just be unchallenged and it can happen. We do know that in the past, presidents have pulled out of treaties unilaterally. But in one case, it was President Carter who did so in 1979. It was a treaty to try a kind of mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. And Carter was trying to improve relations with China. So we pulled out of this treaty. And it was challenged by Barry Goldwater, who was the senator from Arizona at the time. It went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1979, and Goldwater's argument was, well, the president can't just pull out of a treaty that was ratified by the Senate. And you think, well, what did the Supreme Court say? Well, they said, this is not up for judicial review. It was a very divided court case. One justice said, we can't review this until Congress officially by vote challenges this. You can't have just Senator Goldwater or others come and bring this to us. Others said, this is not an issue for our court to decide, period. It's a political question that should be hammered out by Congress and something that this court simply can't review.
So in that example, the Supreme Court punted.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I think the court punted and We also saw a treaty that George W. Bush pulled out of in 2002, but there wasn't a challenge to it that led to a Supreme Court case. So we're kind of sitting here wondering what happens next. Because I guess that's the most important reason to talk about this is this isn't just about climate change. It's about democracy. It's about checks and balances. What happens next, I think, is going to be really interesting.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the environmental impact of the United States withdrawal from international organizations with Bart Elmore, who teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State University. So from what you're saying, basically, a majority of the Senate would have to say we need back into this UNFCCC or the Paris Accord. Is that right?
That's one scenario, although all this will be tested and tried in the future because, you know, some scholars are saying, well, let's just say unknown presidential candidate who supports climate change gets elected in our next presidential election and they come back in. Does this executive order mean that we have to go back and get Senate ratification for the UNFCCC? Mm-hmm. Or can we say the Senate said that? They did that vote in 92, so we don't have to go back to the Senate. As long as the president backs it, we're back in.
Mm.
So there's just a lot of unknowns, to be honest, about what's going to happen as we move forward.
It sounds like a gamble, too, like you, because you don't know who the president will be in 28. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, we got to think internationally here. I think as somebody who's traveled to a lot of these COPs and seen over 190 countries represented at these places, the big thing is the uncertainty it's created. And I think we're facing that in the economy when you have these kind of whiplash policies or these policies that challenge kind of constitutional order. People just don't know who to trust. And I think that's probably the biggest outcome, regardless of how this gets resolved in the long term, of people saying, is the U.S. really with us? You know, are they committed? Can we trust them moving forward?
You mentioned scientists who work there. Could another country just pay their salary and they can just represent themselves? Do they have to represent the United States?
Yeah, it's true that scientists can participate in the IPCC if they're American citizens. It's not like they're prohibited from participating in the IPCC. But I believe that the U.S. contributions via the federal government to the IPCC was in the order of about $2 million annually. It's not a ton, but it'll have an impact. And your question is, I think, twofold. One, how does this affect participation? I think the good news is scientists are free to do their science, so there's some good news there. But if you're a federal official working inside the government who wants to contribute to the IPCC, is there now going to be kind of upper bum or you're going to be prohibited by your agency from participating? The other is the financial. I think that $2 million gap is, you know, who fills that? Where does that money come from? And I think this is a real question where we're seeing donors and individual philanthropists trying to step in. For example, Mayor Bloomberg, when we pulled out of the Paris Accord and we're not giving funding to the UNFCCC, back to that 1992 agreement, Bloomberg actually stepped in as a private philanthropist and filled the U.S. contribution to the UNFCCC, as opposed to, you know, just letting the federal government back out and that money being gone. So for philanthropists out there, I think this is a chance to think about how do you step in as this funding maybe dries up a little bit.
So if an American pays for it, but it's not the federal government, is America in it?
And this is one of the things you see at the COPs. You know, I've been at COPs now where we were in and where we were out as a, you know, U.S. Government. So at COP28 in Dubai, we were there. Our state-level diplomats were there. All the funding was there. Okay, great. I was just in Brazil at COP30. We had no state delegation there. You know, there was no official representatives of the federal government negotiating the deals there. And so in those cases, one of the things that's really amazing is businesses have stepped up. There's pavilions that are called America's Still In or All In. And these are mayors. These are, in some cases, senators who go on their own volition. These are business leaders who are saying, we are here. And our students from Ohio State were actually there chanting that as well. We're, you know, not everybody's gone, folks. There's a bunch of us who are here in the U.S. who want to keep the fight going. And so I have to say that's somewhat heartwarming, especially to see our younger students being the face in some ways of the U.S. at this time. So there is a U.S. presence. It's just not official.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that will continue at the future COPs, even if the State Department doesn't show up.
At the COP30 in Brazil, were there American flags in all the places where there should have been an American flag then? It's all about the visual, so yeah.
Yeah, let's break it down. You know, the blue zone is where a lot of these negotiations happen. They have this blue mm-hmm. zone and the green zone. And the blue zone is where this official space is. You have all these different countries, over 190 countries in there. And every country has a pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful, right? So you can go to Germany. Our students love to figure out which pavilion has the best coffee. You know, mm-hmm. they're always offering different things and kind of going around all this. And that was really striking. There was no U.S. pavilion. So right. not only is the State Department not there, but there's no, as you said, kind of flag mm-hmm. posted there. I'll tell you whose flag was posted there. China, very prominently as you walked in. A bunch of these other countries, which, you know, is another conversation about, you know, who's stepping in mm-hmm. as the U.S. is stepping back. So it was very noticeable. The only senator that we came across that made the journey, in part because the shutdown was happening during the COP30.
So they had the time.
Yeah, they had the time, but no, it was only one senator because the vote happened that week. They had to rush back.
Oh.
So in fact, we had meetings with several representatives from Ohio and other places, and they couldn't meet with us because they had to come back and vote to get the government back open.
Hmm.
And one of the things you're seeing here is the dysfunction that's having effects on climate negotiation beyond just not being a part of the UNFCCC. There's nothing that prevents a Democratic senator or a Republican senator from showing up at COP on their own. But in this case, that was the other problem. We were dealing with our own shutdown crisis, so they couldn't be there on their own. Mm-hmm. So the presence was very muted in Belém, which is at the mouth of the Amazon River in Brazil, where the last COP was.
If it was in the middle of the shutdown, I wonder if we would have had a pavilion anyway, right? Because those would have all been federal employees if running it. So.
You know, Amy, that I think was the most surprising thing was I kept saying, you know, how unfortunate this is, you know, mm-hmm. that our state-level diplomats aren't here and kind of how embarrassing it is, you know, when mm-hmm. the rest of the world is there and they're not there. But I remember going to one panel, a high-level panel, where, you know, it was very clear that people said, we're kind of happy those state diplomats aren't here. Because if they were here for this administration, we probably wouldn't be. It'd probably be monkey wrenching or slowing down the progress that we're actually making. And that was another. I think as somebody who cares about your country and cares about its presence internationally, it's another sour moment for us. This is going to go on whether we're there or not. And I think we have to make a big decision about: are we just really going to say no to the entire world? We don't want to be a part of the conversation. That's what we're doing right now.
We're going to continue speaking with Bart Elmore, who teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State, about the environmental impact of the U.S. exiting many international organizations. That's When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. We're talking about the environmental impact of withdrawal from international organizations and what it means for the United States' standing on the world stage. Still with us is Bart Elmore, who teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State University. Thanks again for being here today, Bart.
Thanks for having me.
So We were just talking about this. How important is it for the United States to be involved in these global climate discussions? Because, you know, we're an admitter of some of the problems that are causing climate change. The whole world, there's no like plastic divider. Everyone breathes all the air.
Right.
So what does it mean for the United States to not be in these discussions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it, that the place to start is to think about 92. We were the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. You know, and I think if you don't have the largest emitter in the room to solve these problems, you're probably not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It is true that China surpassed the United States as the largest total emitter of greenhouse gases somewhere around 2008, 2009. But if we look at per capita, we're still the largest greenhouse gas emitter. And as you said, like, this is something that affects all of us. And if the largest emitters aren't in the room, then we're really not going to solve the problem. I think the second thing I'd say to that question is there is a lot of money being discussed at these conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, folks listening to this may have very different views on, well, should the U.S. be financing X, Y, or Z? But those conversations are happening, and there's a lot of money that's going to be exchange. There's an adaptation fund, for example, that was agreed to at the Paris Accord that was designed to channel billions of dollars towards less industrialized nations so that they could adapt to green their economy to a future economy that's not so based on fossil fuels. We're not going to get where we're going to get unless that transition happens and those financial transactions happen. Now, on the face of it, you say, oh, that seems like a money giveaway. The reality is a lot of people, if you're sitting there, are saying, wow, what an opportunity to create financial connections, to create, you know, investments and so forth and so on. And the dollar figure that's being proposed now is somewhere around $1.3 trillion that annually would be invested in these kind of adaptation programs around the world. Now, if you step back and say, we're just going to, you know, put our head in the sand and the whole rest of the world is going to be talking about these transactions, I mean, if you're a business person out there, I just don't think anybody would think that's a smart idea.
Hmm.
It's going to happen. Whether we hit the $1.3 trillion mark or not, there will be these investments. And will the United States basically abdicate to all these other countries by not being there? So I think those are the two big things that we're missing out on. It's not just that we're not going to solve the climate change issue. I think we're losing out on economic opportunities and investments that could really change the world and be the future of the economy.
Yeah, going to the money was where I was going to go next. Gina McCarthy, a former White House National Climate Advisor, I have a quote from her saying, "This administration is forfeiting our country's ability to influence trillions of dollars of investments, policies, and decisions that would have advanced our economy and protected us from costly disasters wreaking havoc on our country." McCarthy chairs, she's the co-chair of America Is All In, which is what you mentioned from Brazil. So she's talking about trillions of dollars, but it's not just related to investments and policies and the movement of money, but talk about this protection from costly disasters.
Yeah.
Because what if the United States next year has a huge costly disaster where it would be helpful to have international help?
Yeah. And it's not a matter of if, it's when.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's where we're at. The science is so clear on what's happening. You know, we're over 410 parts per million carbon dioxide, which is just, you know, I remember teaching a decade, two decades ago, where we're like, oh, if we get over 360 parts per million of this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're going to be in real trouble. I mean, we are accelerating this problem, and there are tipping points, right? So I'm writing a book about microbes right now, and we're actually going to be headed to places like Svalbard and island that's about,
I don't know where that, I was just going to say, I don't
400
know where
miles
that is.
South for the North Pole. You have to carry a gun with you at all times because there's polar bears out there who are not.
That sounds fun.
They look cuddly, but it turns out they're fairly ferocious. But, you know, the microbiologists are looking at what happens as glaciers melt, what happens as permafrost melts, and this is really critical. And we're seeing microbes that have been frozen for years that are revived. And those microbes can actually consume organic matter and release methane and release greenhouse gases. And this is what we mean by tipping points. Do you get to a point where you're warming up places that have been permanently cold and you're having this kind of boom of greenhouse gas emissions that are going to explode? And this goes to your point of it's not just about investing or helping countries to adapt, but if we don't get involved in this, the cost to the United States of inaction are going to escalate. You know, talk about people that are not putting their heads in the sand. Insurance companies are certainly paying attention to this. Business leaders are seeing the writing on the wall because it's affecting their bottom line and saying, look, this is an economic negotiation. This isn't about protecting those ferocious polar bears, you know. Mm-hmm. This is really about making sure that the United States is in a competitive position where we're not spending our money fixing climate-related problems, but instead investing in really smart technology that's going to help us outcompete our biggest international rivals. So I use that same quote from Gina McCarthy because I think it really, when you're at COP, you feel that. Mm. You're looking around and you're seeing it's almost like a tech expo, you know. You're seeing the new technologies being introduced. You're talking about where the money should flow. You're seeing smart people who are thinking about the business opportunities in the space. And we're just not there.
What other countries are going to step up? Who's going to fill that void? There's a void. Someone will fill it.
Right. So we took some students and alums of Ohio State to COP30 in Beijing, as I said. It was in November, so just a few months ago. And I remember we walked into the Blue Zone and China's pavilion just knocked you in the face. Mm-hmm. Not only in the scale of it, it was just these pavilions, because there's so many countries, you got to kind of have your little, it's almost like a little hut, but this was the biggest pavilion I'd ever seen. They had all sorts of swag they were giving out and things, and it was packed. I mean, every talk that China had, because you have these kind of panels and different things that happen at the pavilions, it was standing room only. I forget about the coffee. You weren't going to get any. I mean, it was so clear. And that's not to expunge China's pollution problems or the issues inside the country. It's just to say that it was clear that you see countries like China stepping into that vacuum and saying, investment opportunities, business deals, hey, we're open. Let's have that conversation.
That's what I was going to say. Was China there to improve the climate of Earth, or is China there to make some money?
I think, like any time you're at COP, yeah, you turn left and you see the guy who's there to protect the climate. You mm-hmm. turn right and you see the person who sees the business opportunity. And I would say this is a legitimate critique of the COPs since really over the last several years. The conference of the parties, these conferences were traditionally fairly small. I mean, yes, you had a bunch of delegates and diplomats, but it was really kind of a government-to-government negotiation. You know, Paris and beyond, they have become something else. I think the Brazil COP was the second largest COP we'd ever had. I forget how many people, tens of thousands of people. And increasingly, you're seeing nonprofit, private sector, business leaders, banks there as well. Some days I feel like that's a great thing, mm-hmm. Because as I said, there's $1 trillion at play. That seems like you're getting everyone involved, seeing the opportunities. Some days I feel like, people are trying to sell you things and are we really fixing the problem? But again, is the best strategy to put your head in the sand and just ignore it? It's happening. So not being there doesn't make much sense.
In the few minutes we have left, you said the big ones that we've left is the UNFCCC, the IPCC, but this list has 66 organizations on it. So, and I mentioned earlier, not to pick on cotton or tropical timber or lead and zinc, but some of these organizations are pretty small and do a very niche thing. Do you feel like the United States leaving these smaller ones will have an impact, or is it the big ones that's the impact we're going to notice?
I think it will be synergistic, right? I mean, you can't fix climate change without protecting biodiversity. We were in the Amazon, and we were talking earlier. You engage in deforestation projects that eliminate biodiverse forests, you're going to have a pretty radical impact on you're going to accelerate climate change in those spaces. So I do think we're missing the story if we don't look closely at all those 60 different organizations. And I would encourage everyone to go out and check out those organizations, because I think there's opportunities for us as citizens. I mean, that's what I'm really, I think, you know, wanted to come and say today is that we do have to step up, you know, as individuals, if we care about this issue. And I know some folks listening out there have financial means to maybe help as a philanthropist. Others of us are saying, gosh, this economy is really tough right now. I'm just trying to get by. So in what ways can we volunteer our time for these organizations? In what ways can we donate our funds to these organizations? Can we target investments to make sure that the gap gets filled? Because I think the historian in me knows that this time's going to change. The political climate's going to change. I mean, it goes back to where we first began. You know, in 1988, I was 7 years old. I can still remember those moments where it felt like we were coming together, you know, and it was a bipartisan effort. I was from Georgia, a state that certainly you have Republican, Democrat friends. You're not going to get very far if you're just in an echo chamber there. And we've got to remember that. We've got to remember those words. This is not a partisan issue. This is a people issue. This is about all of us. And right now, we're the lone wolf walking away from the rest of the world. And so from an ecological standpoint, usually that animal doesn't do very well. So I think we've got to rethink our position and hopefully think about what we can do as private citizens to help out right now.
We've been speaking with Bart Elmore, who teaches environmental and business history at Ohio State University. Thanks for joining us today, Bart.
Thanks so much.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.